The Bastards of Boston Baseball Podcast.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champion. Game over, series over, and the Red Sox are world champs again.
Yes, indeed. Here it comes. Another edition of the Bastards of Boston Baseball.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
The Red Sox split the doubleheader, beating the Cincinnati Reds in today's finale of yesterday's game by a score of 5-3. Then, in a bullpen nightcap, they dropped Game 3 of the series 8-4. A series victory, but just shy of reaching that 500 mark that so many of us wanted to see. Boston's record on the season settles in at 43 wins and 45 losses. I'm Nick the Voice, joined tonight by Jason Kelly and Terry Cushman Jr., and we are the Bastards of Boston. Want more? Go to bastardsofbostonbaseball.com for great written articles posted just about every day. So, fellas, I think that it only makes sense to start this in chronological order. We'll talk about the nice series victory. Brian Baio coming out, picking up really right where Fitz started. Baio with, funnily enough, starting in the fourth inning, might be one of his best starts of the season in a lot of ways. What did you guys think?
I was impressed with Baio, and, you know, it was actually one of our guys, Mark, in the chat room that kind of pointed out, like, he's pitching in a day game. Like, that's kind of risky because we know Brian Baio doesn't typically do well in the daylight, but he pitched pretty well. I mean, it wasn't like jump off the page numbers, you know, three strikeouts. He limited the amount of runs. He made one mistake to Spencer Steer, who is red hot right now. And, you know, a lot of pitchers, that's going to happen, right? Other than that, he was really good. And, you know, I thought Marloni kind of called it out. He's like, you know, I'd let Baio just keep going as long as he can because he's already got that sort of four-inning spot because of the resumed game. So, you know, let him go as deep as he can. And then if you really need to, then you can go to Chapman, which they did. So, I thought Baio was really good. And when you look at his last couple of starts, what he's been doing, kind of moving away from the initial Andrew Bailey method of throwing nothing but breaking balls and not using your fastball, and he's kind of doing the opposite, it looks like it's working. So if this is part of the, you know, that rumor that the pitching staff kind of met with Bailey and said, hey, we hate the way that you have us pitching, then great. They're right, because it's working out for guys like Brian Baio and Lucas Giolito. So that was really encouraging to see.
Honestly, I've said it fairly recently. I think this is looking like it's probably going to be the best season for Brian Baio. And the even better news to that is he's typically a very good second half pitcher. I think I saw a stat. He has like a 360 ERA in all the second halves from 2022 forward. So really encouraging. Just looking at his last five, and actually I would say last six, if you count today, he hasn't given up more than three earned in any of those, except for today, because it was an abbreviated game. He's gone at least six full innings in his previous five starts before today. So you're starting to see everything kind of click with him. I don't know if this is like a breakout year, but it certainly is shaping up to be the best of his career so far. And not a ton of strikeouts today, but the one thing he did get, at least two or three of them, was some very timely double plays. You know, they were grounding into him left and right. And he was able to keep them at bay. So really encouraging there for Bayo, because for a while, I mean, we expected him early on to be a potential number one or number two. Like, I don't think we truly knew where the ceiling was, but I mean, it was certainly possible. And then the last couple of years, you're looking at him and it's like, geez, he might just be a number four, and that's what he is. So the jury's still out, but it's trending in the right direction.
Definitely. And, you know, to add on to that, really at the start of this year, looking at some of the metrics, looking at thinking, oh, well, he was just getting lucky with some of those early successes that he had in the season. There was a lot of fear that he would be yet another starting pitcher that completely melted down for the Red Sox. And instead, he seems to have really settled into a nice sort of cruise control. It's kind of unlucky, really, if you think about it. Five innings pitched, only two base runners allowed. To have that be a two-run home run, that sucks, you know? No strikeouts, like you said, only three tonight, but he's not striking guys out. The control is still iffy, but the weak contact is really, really nice to see. He has an elite ground ball rate, and funnily enough, his fastball velocity is kind of climbing up there. He hits around 95.1 average. It's not too bad. Keeps hard contact limited. That's going to help you a lot of the ways. If he can, and he is only 26 still, if he can put together his arsenal, figure out just some put away pitch, I feel like that could really elevate his game and he could become a mid-rotation anchor. And one other thing I'd like to say about Bayo is you're absolutely right about the vampire sort of mindset that he has come to be known by. Over the course of his career, 3.9 ERA in night games, a 4.98 ERA in day games, over a point higher. So far this year, though, six night starts, 3.38 ERA, 7 day starts, 3.44. Maybe he got some sunscreen. It's nice to see. Another nice thing to see, I loved that game one, we were able to go into a save situation and have Chapman shut the door. I mean, this dude is great. And just being able to use him in that situation, it sort of gave me a sigh of relief. I didn't want to lose the night game. I didn't want to lose game three, but it made it a little more comfortable to know, okay, we got a guy who's lights out there.
And I feel like that was Cora sort of saying, you know what, we can win the series by just winning this resumed game, right? So let's at least do that first. And you know what, if I don't have Chapman for the night game, I'll manage it, right? I'll figure it out later. And, you know, as we'll get to, he didn't figure it out. But nonetheless, like, let's go ahead and win that resume game because you were ahead anyway. You know, Bayo pitched his ass off. You didn't get much offense, but you don't really these days, so fine. Yeah, you have an all-star closer. You have a guy who is going to be a hot commodity on the trade market. And look, depending on what you believe from what Craig Breslow is saying about, well, depending on how we do, we'll either be aggressive buyers or we'll be strategic sellers or whatever it is that he said. I don't know. I think Breslow's basically telling them, go out and win games, and I'll see if I can buy the deadline. But if you don't, I'm going to sell. Like, he basically told you what he's going to do. So I think this is Cora saying, I like having this closer. I like having a guy who comes in and is lights out and gets the save pretty much every time. So yeah, I'm going to go ahead, win the day game, win the series. We'll see what happens with the night game, because I think they must have already known it's going to be a bullpen game anyway. So in Cora's mind, he's going, I'm probably not using Chapman tonight. I'm probably not getting to that point. It's going to be a high-scoring game. Hopefully it's in our favor, but let's at least use him for this. Let's win the series, and then we can feel good going into the night game.
I was thinking kind of the same thing. I mean, Bayo's going to come into the fourth inning. I was thinking he would pitch the whole thing. I'm wondering if that's what the original plan was, because now you have your full bullpen for tonight. And I was kind of hoping that Kyle Harrison might get the start and be the 27th man. It turned out that ended up being Chris. Well, he didn't start, but he was the 27th man. And so that was kind of a bummer. Harrison would have pitched last night, but Worcester was also rained out. So it kind of lined up. But yeah, and I want to touch on something, and I didn't know where I would fit it into the show, but I may as well do it now since Jason went there with Breslow. I don't know if you guys noticed, but in between games, Sam Kennedy was in studio with Tom Caron and emphatically said the Red Sox would be buyers and they're only looking at competing here. And I had an epiphany when that happened. And before I get into that, let me just point this out. I can't remember if I've actually said this on the air or if I just said it in the war room privately. But if you go back to last year, the first week of July, we were a little bit better. I don't know how many games over 500 we were, but we were a little bit better. And we were getting these weird mixed signals. Well, we might be buyers. We don't know. We're not. We're kind of non-committal. And then Eddie Romero, who never really talks publicly to the beat writers, he's typically the international scouting guy. So he was responsible for Bogarts and probably Bayo even, and Devers and all them. That's kind of his lane as far as the front office goes. But he also made a statement last year, probably a little bit later into July, saying, well, we could be buyers, but the second half of the month is going to have to be almost perfect to justify it. So now skip ahead to this year. We're under 500. You know, we had a chance to get there tonight. Now we didn't, and now we're two games under. And so we're under 500. Things are not trending well at all. We're like last in WRC plus. We're just rock bottom in a lot of key categories. And, but we're buyers. We're going to be buyers. And here's my theory on that. Finally, I think they're laying the groundwork to get rid of Breslow. And they're saying they're going to be buyers at the deadline. So that way, when maybe we're not, when maybe we pivot and sell, they're saying we're going to be buyers and we're setting the bar high because that's what we expect, because we're the Boston Red Sox and Craig Breslow didn't get it done. He did not meet those high expectations. So we've made the tough decision to part ways. I'm the fire Breslow guy on this crew. And I think most of us are generally supportive of that, but you know, it's kind of like my thing. You know, I'm looking at it every day and I don't know if I'm going to be right, but that's the vibe that I get. I don't think Sam Kennedy is, I think Sam Kennedy is an Alex Cora guy. I don't think he's a Craig Breslow guy. And we know based on the Passan report that Brian O'Halloran, Eddie Romero, Raquel Ferreira, they don't like Craig Breslow. Nobody likes Craig Breslow. John Henry himself might think, geez, this guy's a moron. He just made me fly all the way to Kansas City because he lost control of the roster. So that's just kind of how I think about it. I'll tell you guys something off the air. I don't think it's appropriate to get into it here. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
You'll leave the viewers and listeners guessing with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think you make a lot of astute observations. I mean, it's obvious to everyone, I think, that Breslow is kind of an odd man out in his own organization. He's sort of a man without a kingdom in a lot of ways. And while you were talking, I actually pulled up the records from last year. It looks like on July 2nd of last year, we were five games above 500, 45-40. On the 30th, we were five games above 500, 56-51. And to think that they looked at that team and did not think that that was a team that was worth believing in, I think that's telling. And the fact that they're looking at this team, which is frisky, has shown signs of life, but ultimately is a below 500 squad at a worse point, a significantly worse point in the standings, maybe not in terms of games back, I don't know that, but in terms of simply win-loss record, I think that says a lot. Ultimately, I feel like a baseball front office, you need to be opportunistic and not desperate. When you're desperate, you make mistakes. When you're opportunistic, you sort of see things open up for you. Last year, I don't know what went into the behind the scenes talking points that ultimately had them sort of do a soft buy. Danny Jansen, come on. It's ridiculous. We got some reliever. I forget which one.
That was ridiculous. Sims.
Yeah, it's just nonsense. I was very upset about that because ultimately doing a soft buy like that, you may as well have sold. You would have gotten more in the long term. As for this year, the team's frisky. The team's fun. There's a lot of positions we can upgrade, a lot of guys we can add, but we're going to need to spend hard for it. And I would not be surprised if you're right, that even if it's not a deliberate alignment to fire Breslow, I think it's almost like a bad omen for him. I think that the winds are changing, definitely, and you're seeing heads butting.
And I wonder if Sam Kennedy, and I hate that I'm giving Sam Kennedy any sort of credit for anything, because he's, you know, he is who he is. But I do wonder if this was strategic on his part, and he sort of went on the Nesson Studio and said this, because look at the next, like, seven games. Washington and Colorado. Two teams you should beat the hell out of. Washington's a little pesky, and James Wood is, like, one of the best players in baseball. But Colorado's a joke. Like, that should be an easy sweep. So this is a great opportunity for them to get back over 500 and show the Red Sox brass, like, yep, this team can win. And I wonder if that was strategic on Kennedy's part, because he goes on Nesson and says, yep, we're going to be buyers. And fans like me and everyone else looks at the schedule and goes, yep, they can win like seven in a row if they really want to and get back in this. And if they don't, if they play sloppy like they did in the night game tonight, where they're chucking the ball all over the place and making stupid base running mistakes, then he can point to the manager. Or he can point to Breslow and say, hey, you know, maybe they wouldn't have lost if you didn't trade away their best player because you lied to him all offseason and pissed him off. Like, I do wonder if there's a little bit of that in play where they're looking for a scapegoat because they know the fans are pissed. They know that fans, especially after a game like tonight, are really frustrated. And he's sitting there going, yep, we can be buyers, no problem. But then if the Red Sox go out and blow it against Washington and Colorado, then he can sit there and say, well, yeah, we said we're going to be buyers, but we got a really good bunch of phone calls about Jaron Duran. So, you know what? Maybe buying isn't the best thing for us. It's so typical Red Sox because, once again, they're lying to your face on TV, but they're sugarcoating it just enough that, like, you kind of buy in a little bit. You go, okay, oh, great, yeah, maybe they will be buyers. And then if they lose one game against Colorado, it's, yeah, Jaron Duran is, you know, those trade talks are heating up. Or, oh, they've gotten calls about Alex Bregman because they've heard how good his rehab is going. So get ready for that. They'll spin it one way or the other. But I can't believe a word that comes out of Kennedy's mouth. He says they're going to be aggressive buyers. If they don't, like, win the next seven, if they go 4-3, then they're going to sell. It's just, it makes too much sense not to. Like, you can't go into the All-Star break under 500 and go, yeah, we're going to be buyers. That's stupid. That's absolutely stupid, and no team would do it.
If you go 4-3 in the next seven, you're still one game under. So.
Exactly. Yep.
So it's not, yeah. And we are playing the Rockies at home, so I'll say with confidence that's 2 out of 3 minimum that you should win. I don't know if there's pitching matchups for Washington, but I don't like this. I don't like this series for us. I mean, James Woods can absolutely destroy us. You know, that's just, it's a young team that's just kind of pesky. And one of these years they will have that epic breakout, and they do have a top 2 or 3 farm system as well. So they're very well, positioned to have a window opening more sooner than later. One thing about game two, I've got some trade things I'd like to get to after that, but let's just talk about that seventh inning real quick. So Weissert gets up. He's the most cooked reliever in Major League Baseball. The most appearances. And to his credit, I mean, he got thumped pretty good tonight, but I mean, he hasn't been terrible. And, but I just, the bases loaded, no outs. And then that crappy first baseman, he's got a hyphenated last name, Strand. I'm not a Reds guy, obviously, but
Encarnacion Strand. Yeah.
That's it.
Yes. Yep. Yes. I wonder if there's any relation to Edwin then. But he hits the grand slam, and just a 3-0 lead goes to a 4-3 one-run deficit. And the Red Sox showed a little bit of life either in the bottom half of that inning or maybe it was the eighth, but not enough. And then we got to them again. But I just think it was a terribly managed game for Cora. I almost would have had somebody relieving just out of principle in that bullpen with Weissert in there just in case. And, you know, the game sped up too fast and there was nobody up. I remember Marloni, bases loaded, no outs. The grand slam hadn't happened yet, but he's like, there's still nobody up in the pen warming. And I'm like, I didn't think they were going to put four up right away, but I could feel it going sideways, and it definitely did.
Yeah, you know, it's just more of the same. It's overuse. The fact that we started this year, and I looked at our depth chart of starting pitchers, and sure, a good amount of them were injured to start the year, but with probable return dates that were reasonably around July, I thought, man, starting pitching is going to be great for us this year. And then, you know, we trade Newcomb, who was a great innings guy. We trade Priester, who's been good for the Brewers. Hauk turns into not just a pumpkin, but a rotting one. It's caving in on itself, like something that's been left out in the rain deep into November after Halloween. It's not good. Unfortunately, we did have Criswell, but he just pitched heavy, I believe, on Saturday night down in AAA, so he couldn't do a proper start. What concerned me is, first off, I mean, I've been talking about how Weissert's usage, just how much he's been being sent out there to pitch. Cora did it to Bernie. He's doing it to Weissert. And Bernie looked cooked. He did all right tonight. Weissert looked cooked. Now, I'm very concerned for his arm and for his long-term health as far as the season goes. What I'm curious about, where the heck was Garrett Whitlock? Whitlock, you have a guy who has started in the past. He's pitched two innings regularly this year, and I know many times we've complained that maybe he shouldn't have been, but in a game like this, if you have to roll out a group of seven relief pitchers, the odds of one of them having an off night is pretty darn high, it feels like. And sure enough, we got that with both Weissert and Hicks tonight, definitely damaged by further errors, sloppy defense, just sloppiness all around, I think. But Garrett Whitlock, he hasn't pitched since June 29th, only pitched 10 games in June, 3.09 ERA. You really would think that that's a guy you'd at least send out there to maybe try to go three innings, see what happens, similar to what Chris Murphy did, who looked pretty great.
I think the plan had to have been for Whitlock to come out in the eighth. I just think that's how he mapped it out in his head. So I don't know who could have come in for Weissert when things started going sideways, but you know, if it was Justin Wilson, for instance, perhaps you only give up one or two runs instead of the grand slam.
Yeah. And especially with a day off tomorrow, like, you know, what is Whitlock doing riding the pine when you've got a day off to, you know, to deal with? Like, it just makes no sense. And I think, Terry, you're probably right. I think Cora had it in his mind that Whitlock was going to come out for the eighth and ninth and close out the entire game, you know, do the two-inning thing again. But, like, why Weissert? In a close game like this, you go to the guy who you've used the most? Like, I'm not a big Justin Wilson fan, but that probably would have yielded a better result. And I feel like Cora just, he has just his guys that he just goes to. He's like, nope, I'm going to go to Weissert now and it's all going to be fine. And like, okay, I get it. Weissert, as you mentioned, Nick, he hasn't been bad this year. He's been pretty good. Like, even despite the high usage, he's been good. But then once he puts two runners on, don't you start getting the bullpen a little bit loose? Like, okay, before this gets away from us, let's have a backup plan. Let's get Whitlock going. Let's get Wilson going. Nothing. He didn't do anything. And then it just got worse and worse and worse because, you know, Weissert just kind of lost control. Defense behind him certainly didn't help. Red Sox played with their heads up their asses again in the field. But, like, why not have something going in the bullpen? It's just, once again, it's one of those games where Cora was asleep at the wheel. Like, is two games in one day too much for you, Alex? Do we need Ramon Vasquez to take game two because you're just too tired for managing half of game one? Like, is that what it is? It just, there was no excuse for that. None whatsoever.
Yeah, it's frustrating to see. It really does seem, and this has always been a problem with Cora, it seems like he gets into autopilot almost. You know, it's like he goes through the motions, and he has a script, and he sticks to it. and he doesn't really make adjustments when it comes to the pitching staff, and it's frustrating to see. It's lost us a lot of games in the past, probably lost us tonight.
Let's talk about Willy Abreu real quick.
Yes.
We don't know who he is yet. I mean, he goes on these epic streaks. He had a monster homestand. I don't have the stats up in front of me, but it probably hit 3 or 4 dingers. I think I saw something. He was 8 for his last 22. And I'm just wondering, is Breslow taking calls on him right now? Just are other teams inquiring? Like, listen, you have Abreu, you have Duran. I think everybody knows there's not really a world, probably beyond this season, where both guys are going to be in the lineup. You get Roman Anthony up. You'll have one of Duran or Abreu. You got Rafael in the outfield. The password will probably be up at some point next year. I just don't see a world where they're both on the roster. Perhaps through the trade deadline, neither one get traded, but there have to be calls, I would say. And I think, as crazy as this may sound, and perhaps you'll both disagree with me, and that's fine, but I'm still pro Duran. He's still my guy right now. And there's just too much inconsistency with Abreu right now. And he had that hot start. He was all the rage in the first week of the season. And then he got cold. And I'm thinking, man, he just, whatever trade value he had, it's kind of fizzled right now. And now he's heating up again. I don't know. Where are you guys at with this?
I think I'm still pro Duran too, and it's really close, because when Abreu has weeks like this where he's just hitting the crap out of the ball, and you factor in the fact that he's a couple years younger, you know, maybe profiles as having a higher ceiling than Duran, then it's like, man, yeah, you are going to get calls about Abreu. And unfortunately, they're going to get calls about both Abreu and Duran. Unfortunately, the packages you could get for Abreu will be better than the ones you can get for Duran, because teams are going to factor in his age. They're going to factor in the fact that he had a breakout year last year, but it was 1 year. He hasn't followed up on it yet. His power is down this year. Even his base running is down. And I've been kind of saying to people, like, to me, Duran looks maybe a half a step slower. I don't know. Like, I feel like there are a couple of ground balls where I'm like, oh, Duran's going to beat this out, or at least be close, and he's not. Like, it's a routine play. I'm kind of going, are those legs starting to slow down already? Because the other thing about Jaron Duran that we know is that he's a workout freak. He's a gym rat. And it looks like he put on a lot of muscle, and I wonder if that took away from his speed a little bit, which is one of the things that made him such a dynamic player last year. And again, he hit 20-plus homers last year. So is he on the Andrew Benintendi track of, well, now I hit 20 homers, now I got to go for 30 because I have to earn my money because I'm a late bloomer and they've got me under team control. So, you know, I got to buff up in the winter, and I got to flip more tires around and add more muscle, which, okay, that's fine. But he does look a tad slower. He's only got 15 stolen bases this year. He's been caught 5 times. So he's getting thrown out more too. And he slipped defensively. I mean, he's, you know, dropping fly balls. He's, you know, overthrowing the cutoff man. Nate Eaton's had to save his bacon a couple of times. He's still making stupid base running mistakes too. So unfortunately, I still really like Duran. It sounds like I'm crapping on him, but I don't think that he's the guy you trade. I think Abreu is, because you can just get way more in return. And I have doubts about Abreu's consistency. I have doubts if he can hit left-handed pitching consistently. And obviously so does Alex Cora. So if he's going to be a platoon player anyway in Cora's mind, and he's not going to play against lefties, and he goes on these stretches where he goes, you know, 2 for 24 over a 2-week span, I think that's the guy you got to take the calls on. And if you can get a really good pitcher in return, or you know, a really good package in return, that's, I think, what you've got to do, because at the end of the day, Roman Anthony's not going to be your DH forever. He's going to be in the outfield somewhere. I have no interest in any conversation involving moving Rafaela. Like, you guys know how I feel about Sadon. He's my guy. So, and I think he's starting to show it. Like, elite defender, and now the bat is starting to come around. You're going to want that guy. And they've already locked him up anyway, so might as well keep him. And I want Duran in left. I just think that he can figure it out. He can turn it around. And for a guy under team control like that, you get the most out of him that you can. And then when he's 33 and he's starting to slow down, then here comes the password, as Terry brought up, right? Here comes Yostinson. Like, fine, no big deal. So to me, Abreu is a guy I still move. I just think you get a much better return. I think for where this team is right now, that's what you need to focus on.
Yeah, I think that's very valid. You know, while you were talking, I actually just decided to bring up his Savant page just for the heck of it to look at his sprint speed. And in 2023, he went from 29.5 average sprint speed to 29.6. And now this year it is down to 29.1. That's fairly significant. He goes from the 96th percentile to the 91st, still extremely fast, but to your point, very well may be something to look at. For me, I am a Willier Abreu guy. I want Abreu on the team, and there's a couple of reasons that you guys have already touched on. The age is a factor. Duran's sort of lack of range, really. His defense last year looking to be the outlier concerns me, definitely. And it sucks because I love the guy's intangibles. I love the guy as a dude. I love him as sort of a dirty dog, right? But Willier Abreu right now is leading the team in home runs. He's up to 17 right now, which puts him at 21st in the league, across both leagues, I'm pretty sure. And that ties him, funnily enough, with Rafael Devers. 17 home runs apiece. Now, this team, the offense has been lacking a lot of dimensions this year. It's been flat in a lot of ways. But one particular point of issue, really, is the fact that we don't have a lot of pop. We don't have those big home run threats. You get rid of Devers, you lose one of the only guys on the team who gives you that big home run threat. You get rid of Abreu, suddenly your top two home run guys are gone, and the guy leading the team in home runs, I'm pretty sure, would be Trevor Story. It is concerning. I like Willier. It's one of those situations where I don't think there's a wrong answer. You know, Duran is a good player and a great guy. He's a great locker room presence. He's fast, he's dynamic, he's fun. Abreu, he's younger, he's sharper in the field. He has maybe a little more upside in terms of getting that ball over the fence, muscling that ball out. So far this week, he has slugged .808. Coming back from that injury maybe has wakened something up with him. And, you know, it's true that Abreu struggles with lefties. He hasn't been getting a lot of opportunities, but he has struggled with lefties across his career. So is Duran. And for some reason, Abreu is the only guy getting platooned. Yostinson, from what I understand, the password who's coming up, they say that he has good bat with plus power. And from what I understand, particularly good power against lefties. So you never know. Maybe an Abreu password platoon, sort of like how we were using Ref Snyder, maybe that could be the future and maybe that could be very dangerous. For me, I'm sticking with Willier on this one.
I'm so tired of platoons. You know, you look at 2007. You didn't really have one. I mean, Ellsbury came up late. So, you know, I guess they had what, Coco Crisp. Maybe there was a platoon earlier in the year, but you know, you had JD Drew, Manny Ramirez, Jacoby Ellsbury. That was your outfield. Your infield, you know, from first base over to third, you had, what, Euclid Pedroia, who was short that year, 07. Lugo wasn't great, but, and then Mike Lowell. There were no platoons, really. And then in 2013, your only real platoon was Nava and Gomes, and that was fine. In 2018, you definitely had Moreland and Pierce. Was there an outfield platoon? I don't think so. Benny, Jackie. So. Yeah. So, I mean, historically, you know, more than one platoon is just you're not a big market team. So I'd like to get away from that. I don't care if Duran goes and Willier stays, fine. I'll live with it. But I just think Duran is the everyday guy. And I think this year, you know, last year was one extreme, and I think this year's the other. I think his metrics will be better in 2026. And we're not making it to October, but if we did, who's to say Duran isn't the Kike Hernandez from 2021?
Yeah, and the only thing I would hesitate on a little bit is I don't want to just give away either Duran or Abreu and have this notion of, well, Yostinson will be up in like a year. Like he just got to AAA this year, and he's what they thought Miguel Blaze was going to be. Right, right-handed power bat, good against lefties. Miguel Blaze kind of dropped off the map a little bit. Like he's dropped in their rankings. He was a guy that, you know, a lot of teams called on. The Red Sox were like, nope, we're not trading him because we need right-handed power bats. So I don't want to like put all that pressure on Yostinson now and be like, oh, you're the future right-handed power bat. Like we got to find a spot for you. I don't know. I hope that's true. At least from what I've seen from him on, you know, in spring training and a little bit of the Worcester games I've caught, looks pretty good. Looks like a good, you know, athletic player, big guy, obviously has a ton of raw power, but let's let him develop a AAA a little bit too. Like I think sometimes we get into this pattern of, well, we can trade this guy because we have this guy in the minors. Like I heard people after Devers was traded, well, we got Blaze Jordan. Blaze Jordan's been in the minor leagues for like 10 years, it feels like. I know that's not true. He's only like 22 or 23 years old, but feels like he's been here forever, and he just got to AAA now. So let's, you know, not every prospect is Roman Anthony. Not every prospect is Marcelo Meyer. Look what happened to Christian Campbell. They accelerated him. They signed him to the extension. He's in AAA now, trying to refine his swing and trying to learn how to play the field. So, you know, look, I want them to, if they decide to sell, then sell properly and be smart about it. Right, whether it's Duran or Abreu, make sure you get maximum return. Right, I'm okay with that at this point because I don't think this year's team is worth overly investing in. Right, if they're gonna buy, like, don't sell any of your top prospects for a pitcher if you're just gonna get knocked out in the wild card round. Right, but if you're gonna sell, and it is a guy like Willier Abreu, I don't want to see the kind of return you got for Rafael Devers because that was pathetic. And they need to be a lot better about that. And Breslow needs to do a lot better than that if he's going to sell. So I'm okay with it, but sell properly and don't just say, oh, we've got this guy in the minors. He can just replace Abreu in the depth chart. It doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, and, you know, on top of that, it's very true that, you know, I like platoons in ways, you know. I think that the idea of Masataka Yoshida, future first baseman, apparently, from what we've been seeing, that must be one of the shortest first basemen in league history if he really does.
5'8".
I mean, you can't do that. You just can't. The fact that they're even working him out there, I think, tells you everything you need to know.
If you're in first place right now, go ahead and tease that. Be like, yeah. Oh, it's adorable. He's working out at first. If you're in fourth, get out of here. Get out of here. It's not funny. Focus on, you know, the shit that needs to be focused on.
Make him a DH and, you know, sure, make him a fifth outfielder, I guess, in a pinch. But, you know, we have too many stop gaps this year that have just become full timers. I thought that Toro, who has been doing well overall, but I thought Toro and Romy were kind of going to be like a Band-Aid. You know, we didn't go into this with the goal of, oh, let's get a great platoon. Like Moreland Pierce was something that happened very naturally. Moreland was our guy. And then we got to midseason and we said, you know, Moreland struggles a bit with lefties. Pierce is a lefty killer. Let's go out and get him and make a complete player with these two guys. And it ended up being a big, big showing in the World Series for us. Both of those guys showed up and were amazing. So I like platoons if you sort of have the idea in your head, oh, let's go out and let's take two incomplete players and make them into one. But I completely agree. You can't, like I said, you know, you're right. It's ridiculous to assume that any guy in AAA is going to pan out. You never know. That can't be something that the Boston Red Sox builds around. That's something that the Chicago White Sox build around. The concept of, well, we got these AAA guys. So you're absolutely right about that. It's just very frustrating to have so many injuries, and now suddenly, you know, David Hamilton's getting starts. Toro Romy. I got it backwards there. You know, the hybrid, whatever it is, you know, that is the full-time option. It's just frustrating. And I never, ever in a million years want to see Toro at third base again.
So when he's at third base, he looks like Tony Romo trying to handle a field goal. Like,
he really does. Yeah,
seriously. Oh, keep him at first. Don't put him at third ever again.
It's ugly. I mean, Meyer really, he needs to be on the left side of the infield. Always.
I was just trying to grab Christian Campbell's numbers up. He was 5-for-21, which obviously isn't great. These are his major league numbers. But he is playing first base down in Worcester, which is why that was relevant. But so real quick, I want to get into, this is my other hypothetical. Trevor Story is hitting in the last 30 games, .292 with a .328 on base, 6 home runs, 26 runs batted in. That is a dramatic turnaround compared to the month of May. And I mean, he seemed like he was days, if not hours, from getting DFA'd. When we went to Atlanta, something clicked. He hit a home run. I talked about it on the podcast. It went like literally right over my head. Right off the bat, I'm like, wow, Story just crushed this. And he, you know, he's kept his foot on the accelerator the entire time. And then in the last week, he's even more impressive. He's hitting .385 with a .429 on base, .654 slugging. And so this could be a, you know, a pipe dream type thing, but I was looking at the shortstops, and every playoff team basically has their shortstop. So there's not a world where a team calls up the Red Sox and takes Trevor Story off your hands to play shortstop for that team. But most of those teams do not have a second baseman. And I think Trevor Story could help most teams with that position. Now, he's got an opt-out after this year. We know that's not happening. But there's only 2 years left, roughly $44 million after the 2025 season. It's not the biggest gamble in the world. Is there a team desperate enough that may say, are you interested in moving Story?
It would depend heavily on what that kind of team is, because even if Trevor Story returns to his Colorado form, he's going to strike out 230 times this year. He just is. Even when he was at his best, he was a strikeout machine. And there are a lot of teams, unlike the Red Sox, that value guys who don't strike out. That they look at players like that and they go, he strikes out too much. I don't care that he hits 30 home runs. We don't need him, right? Like a team like the Brewers would never take on a guy like Trevor Story, which is weird because they took on Rhys Hoskins, which I still think isn't a match, and I think he's going to be gone by the deadline because the Brewers are speed, contact, walks, bunts, like, and then we're going to pitch our asses off and we're going to beat you that way, right? So it depends on who you're reaching out to. There might be a market, but you're not going to pull off what you did with Rafael Devers. You're eating some of that money. If you're trading Trevor Story because he had a hot June and maybe he has a hot July as well, God willing, you're still eating some of that money. No team is going to pay him his full contract, the remainder of it. A lot of it has to do with the age, too. He's 33. So at some point, he's going to break down even more. He's had a lot of injuries in the past couple of years, and his defense has slipped. Now, like you said, putting him at second base, he'd probably be really good there, right? But the strikeouts are just such a it's such a bugaboo with him that, yeah, you might be able to find a dumb team that is just so desperate for a right-handed bat, and they're looking at him and go, okay, he might run into a few and help us win a couple of games, fine, but you're taking 50% of the salary. We're not taking on all of it. So, and the other concern I would have is, do you have to attach a prospect to it to make the deal go through? In which case, I'm not sure I'm willing to do it. Because now if it's a low level, like, you know, your number 23 prospect who's in high A and, you know, isn't doing anything, fine, maybe that. But if they're asking for like a top 15 prospect to be attached to the deal, then no, I'm hanging up the phone. I'd rather keep Story for his leadership and the fact that I do think the young players look up to him. I do think that he has a certain presence in that locker room. So it's got to be the right kind of deal. I don't see it happening. I really don't.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, Story, it's true. Really right now, if you look at his season, he had a bad May. Not a bad season, but a bad month. So that's encouraging. You know, he had a nice April, a very nice June. If he continues to play into that this month, it would be very interesting to see if there's any rumors at all, because the contract is very tough. It's very tough. Maybe you could, that seems to be the word of the day, get a desperate enough GM. It's very possible. You have a guy who is looking to keep his job this year, make it to the playoffs this year, and he doesn't really care about a bad contract because he's already worried, I'm probably losing my job by the end of this year anyway. I'm not sure if there's a right fit for a market like that, but if there is, I would be open to it. I mean, just for the money's sake, save the money, maybe spend it on someone else. You never know.
So I'm just trying to compile a list right now of teams that could use him. And let's also keep in mind, this is probably going to be the last best chance for the Red Sox to do it, to try to facilitate some type of a trade. And, you know, if he gets hotter throughout the next however many days, 27 days, you know, perhaps the market could heat up a little bit more. But the Mariners, Guardians, Braves, Astros, and Blue Jays all have gaping holes at second base. So those are the teams I would look at. I think Jerry DePoto in Seattle, there could be a little bit of desperation there. You know, on paper, they look great every year, but never really make it. I think they've made the postseason one time since the, you know, post-pandemic. Guardians don't tend to spend a lot of money, so that's probably a longer shot. Braves, Astros, Blue Jays could absorb most, if not all of it. So I don't know. And then what would the alignment look like? I almost feel like you have to put Rafaela in the infield at least for the remainder of the year, and I hope that wouldn't be permanent, but
I mean, as far as I see it, like, if we're selling Trevor Story, we're not in contention at that point. You just suck it up and play David Hamilton for the rest of the year, and, you know, just own the fact that, you know what, we are not anywhere near the wild card race, you know.
Well, you're getting Bregman back. So, you know, I think an infield, I don't know who's first. I mean, just say Toro and Romy for now. But, you know, then you'd have potentially, let's see, Rafaela at second, I would say. He's a better second baseman than shortstop. Then put Meyer at short. Bregman's at third. That's not a bad infield. I think you need a first baseman, and if we're buyers, I think that's going to happen. And then your outfield, you've got Duran and Anthony in there just about every day, and you still have your Ref Snyder Abreu platoon. I think there is. I don't think Trevor Story really affects the outcome, regardless.
Yeah, I think if we end up, you know, getting rid of Story, I doubt he'd be the only one. You know, I really would be surprised if come opening day of next year, both Duran and Abreu are on the team. Unfortunately, it really just does seem like they're fighting for a very similar spot on this team. One supplying maybe a little more speed, a little more dynamite, one supplying maybe a streaky but power-driven approach. But at the end of the day, wins are wins. How you get them doesn't really matter if you're, you know, a leadoff man that's extending singles into doubles and causing chaos on the base paths, or if you're absolutely just hammering a ball over the wall. It would be interesting to see. I mean, I would just be hesitant to put Rafaela back into the infield just because I view him as the long-term attempt at platinum Glover out in center field. I'd like to see him keep developing that.
Well, he's probably saved so many games for us this year. So I it's definitely not something I want long term, but if you're trying to have it both ways and
right.
You're trying to still compete, you know, I just think you've got the depth to do that. Duran was a second baseman. You could mess with that. I don't think I would, but yeah. And, Campbell is hitting 185 in Worcester right now. So,
you know what I see though? I see that he has walked 9 times. So his on base is like close to 500 at the moment.
Yeah. Yep.
Sort of a weird sample size there.
Yeah, I mean, he was drawing a ton of walks. I think that's why he didn't get optioned sooner than he did. So, I mean, eventually the walks aren't going to really woo me. It's the batting average is going to have to come up.
Yeah, I mean, really, for the batting average to be salvaged by walks, you need a solid floor and a stellar eye, you know, and those types of player, like a Schwarber-esque, even if you removed Schwarber's power and all of his home runs were just like doubles or something like that. You would still have an on base that was very respectable just because of the weird nature of his bat. Campbell's right. Not Schwarber, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Campbell might be a lot of things, but Kyle Schwarber is not one of them.
No, probably not. You'd want him to profile more like a Carlos Santana, where, you know, okay, yeah, his average is 240, but his on base is like 380, and he can hit 15 to 20 bombs. Campbell might be more capable of more power than that, but that's the kind of player you want.
Yeah, so, you know, it's going to be interesting seeing some of the guys coming back from injury, you know, seeing where Masataka Yoshida fits into this organization, really. I mean, he felt like the odd man out, and now he kind of feels like cavalry almost in some ways, where you're kind of hoping for that slap hitter high average approach, especially if you do pair him with Ref Snyder and have that sort of more complete profile. We don't have a set list of probable pitchers for the Nationals. However, I did go back just to sort of look at their rotation starting from June 28th. So I have 3 names that we might see. You know, I can't guarantee it necessarily. But yeah, let me see here. Oh, interesting. It looks like the Nationals don't have a day off tomorrow. Oh, you know what happened with them? They had a doubleheader today too. So that's why their rotation is sort of thrown off at the moment. So a couple of names that we might see are Mike Soroka, who has been honestly pretty great for them this year. The ERA looks inflated. If you look under the hood, the strikeouts per 9, really good. 64 Ks right now in 59 innings. Really good control at the moment. Really good at inducing weak contact. He fails a little bit as far as, you know, chase rate or average exit velocity, stuff like that. But overall, he's been throwing the ball pretty good. They also have Mitchell Parker and Trevor Williams, both of whom look significantly less interesting. I think Soroka is kind of one of those almost sneaky win type of guys. You send him out on the mound, you don't quite expect to win, or the opposing team certainly doesn't expect, but they find a real hard team or a hard time hitting him. Guys like Parker and Williams, I mean, those are guys you can hit, but God knows the Red Sox love to make bums look like Cy Young sometimes.
Yeah.
As far as R3, we have Lucas Giolito on July 4th. That's an 11 a.m. start time. Then on the 5th, 4 p.m., Walker Buehler takes the mound. So that'll just be great. And then a crochet day at 1:35 p.m. on July 6th. You know, I saw a few days ago, I guess, sometime last week, where You know, they announced Walker Buehler's next start date. And to me, I just thought to myself, man, it's kind of weird telling your opponent when you plan on losing, isn't it? It really feels futile right now.
It does. I don't really know what to expect with this series, but it sounds like we're not going to be facing their best starter. So perhaps you do win two out of three at least, but
that would be nice. I think unironically, we might, if we get lucky, you plant like Buehler versus Soroka, pretty much have our worst pitcher versus their best, just punt on the game and just go out there and hope Giolito and Crochet and the offense can do their job and get you a series win. That's the ideal, I think, at this point. A sweep is not happening.
So unfortunately, yeah. It looks like it's going to be Giolito against Soroka, Buehler against Parker, which still could be, that could still work out for, I don't trust Buehler as far as I can throw him. So I figured that's going to be a loss. I do think you could win two out of three, especially if Giolito keeps pitching the way that he has been. Mike Soroka's nice. He's kind of a reclamation project for them. He was, you know, one of the Braves' young studs before he got hurt. The Braves kind of let him go because he never really found it again. Nationals picked him up because why wouldn't they? So he's been a little bit of a project for them, but I think, especially 11 a.m. start, that's weird for pitchers. So it might be one of these weird sort of 9-6 games where the offense just tees off. But I do think you win two out of three. Like, just if you can avoid it, don't pitch to James Wood. Just don't pitch to James Wood. Don't, you know, if there's no runners on base, just put him on. He's kind of reaching that territory at this point. And I think Crochet will go out there and deal. I don't think I'll have much of an issue with that Nationals lineup. So you should win two out of three this weekend. But I don't know. Weird things happen when they go in National League parks. So I wouldn't be shocked if it goes the other way. But
definitely.
We'll yeah.
In lieu of Trevor Williams, too, we might also see Jake Irvin, who's very much the same profile. I mean, it really does seem like they have Soroka and company in their rotation right now. Hopefully the bats can feast off of that. Only one way to find out. Any closing comments, or should we end it there?
Red Sox lead MLB in doubles, and it's not even close. 172 to 151. Diamondbacks are second. And the only reason I was looking is because I was just kind of looking at seeing where the Nationals were, and they're kind of middle of the pack and kind of in the bottom third as far as most offensive stats go. So theoretically, it should be at least two out of three for the Red Sox.
Yeah, I'm going to say two out of three, I think.
My final thought is I want to see Roman Anthony actually throw a baseball this weekend and not lob it into the infield from wherever he is in right field if he plays. Can we stop doing that? Does he not know how to throw a baseball too? So they have to teach him how to scoop up a ground ball in the outfield. Now they teach him how to throw. Throw the ball, Roman. Throw it. Use your arm and throw it. Stop lobbing it over the infielders' heads, please.
Yeah, we just need to tighten up the whole product across the board at the end of the day. I need not just less errors, but I mean, there have been quite a few plays this year from many parties where it feels like it almost should have been an error. It was ruled a hit and, you know, our guy makes it, you know, he flops out there like a baby goat. So it really is tough. We just need to tighten up. At this point, we are in make or break territory. This is going to be the make or break month. And this Cincinnati trip is going to be a very important series. I don't think there's going to be an unimportant series from here on out. So until next time, thank you guys so much for joining us. Hope you all have a wonderful rest of your day. I have been Nick, joined by Jason and Terry. We have been the Bastards. Let's go, Red Sox. Try to win another series.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper. Distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.